So, Liz, have you heard about this alphabet technique to calm yourself down
No,
before you go to sleep?
but I need it.
Okay. I heard this, I don't know, someplace like on Instagram, or I'm not on TikTok, but I think that's where it originated. But anyway, it's this woman who is actually like an ADHD coach.
Oh.
And from what I understand, people who have this neurological condition, their mind is like racing all the time, right? Racing, racing. And I don't think this is just people with ADHD. I mean, who among us has not laid in bed thinking about all the awkward conversations that you had that day? Oh, just replaying everything. But anyway, so you're laying in bed and you pick a category of anything, could be fruits, vegetables, cities, composers, whatever. And you focus on your breathing. On the inhale, you think about the letter. On the exhale, you think about a word from that category that starts with that letter. So it might be apple.
That's what I was thinking about.
Yes. And you go through the whole alphabet. So B, banana, cantaloupe, whatever your next word would be. And so it just kind of helps you to keep your brain occupied, but not on anything that's high stakes, and lets you calm down internally by controlling your breath, this kind of thing. And I swear I never get like to M.
You don't get
I'm
to
always asleep. I never get halfway through.
M. Do you do this every night?
Most nights I do, since I learned about it.
That's good to know. Well, I'll have to try it. I'll have to try it tonight.
Yeah, try it. Try it, you guys. Please. Welcome to the Musician-Centric Podcast. We are two freelance violists living and laughing our way through conversations that explore what it means to be a professional musician in today's world. I'm Steph.
And I'm Liz. And we're so glad you've joined us. Let's dive in. Happy New Year, everybody.
Oh my gosh, that's right. We haven't even talked to you since last
It's been a
year.
long time.
So, how's your new year going? How are your resolutions coming along? How many have you broken?
Your favorite thing, resolutions.
I hate resolutions. I never make them.
I haven't made any resolutions either. I am in a year of just kind of going with the flow. I'm just going to ride it out and see what happens. I think everyone's January was like an eternity long.
So long. Are all these memes
Is it
like
always
tomorrow's the 85th day of January?
Is it always like that?
Don't know. It definitely has felt like the longest month ever.
When, I mean, really, yesterday was the last day of January for when we're recording this. When you look back at January 1st, so much life has happened, and yet so little life has happened for me. It's really interesting. I've been taking a lot of
Yeah,
time. Space
nice.
has been a really grateful thing. I feel like it's just, I don't know, I'm kind of allowing winter to just give me an opportunity to rest. And I keep joking about this, but we'll see what happens as the months go on. I can't remember the first person who echoed this sentiment to me, but I was saying, yeah, I mean, right now I'm just like not in a hurry. I'm just taking a lot of time to myself. And I like the idea of keeping it this way all year. And then I said, but you know, springtime Liz is a different story. She's a different girl. We'll have to see what
I'm shaking my head. It's a nice thought.
happens. Also, though, I'm sure I have said something very similar in previous years, even on this podcast, that maybe winter is just a good opportunity to like go slow and just be okay going slow, because that's really what our bodies want to do anyway.
Just like sleep is a good time for recharge, January is a good time for recharge.
Hopefully I did a lot of that. I'll try to display it. I have a vision board in my.
Oh, take a picture and we'll put it on our
Okay, I
Instagram.
will. How about you? You had a really great.
Oh, yeah. I was up in New York, but not in the city, in the state, at a musical retreat called Magic Mountain Music Farm, which I've gone to before. And it was really, really wonderful. It was time where I didn't have any of my usual responsibilities, and I was able to focus on just music, just the betterment of my craft, really thinking deeply about my musical ideas and my musical identity, and being with people who were also on that same journey. And it was just a beautiful, picturesque. We'll post some pictures. Maybe we'll put your vision board and some pictures from my retreat. But it was really recharging. And it's a good way to start the year, I feel like, because it kind of gets me back in the mindset of, oh, I'm a musician first. You know, I have all these other qualities, but this is where my heart really lies. And you get pulled away from that sometimes just with the whole year of being in the world.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's really cool. I'm sure anybody who hears you describe it would say, "Oh my gosh, yeah, go away for a couple of weeks and just be immersed in your musical project, whatever that was for the time and however that translates. It's just like setting things in motion and or planting seeds.
Yes, that's really what I was after. I just need lots of seeds.
Yeah.
And we'll just see what starts to grow.
You know? Yeah. When you think about it, that's really like this time of year, those things are all dormant a little bit. And then once springtime comes, they make this sort of like actually sometimes painful, like burst to the surface and then they flourish. And I think there's so much in nature, I think recently about that. I'm like, yeah, if I can just kind of remember that this is sort of the cycle of things that happen in life. For anything else that exists on our planet as well. It's kind of nice. It's kind of takes the pressure off if like you're at a phase in your life that you're not really, you want to be somewhere else, but sometimes,
right.
Sometimes not.
Yeah.
Sometimes
that's a really lovely thought. Like we're just part of, we're another life form on this earth. And why wouldn't we have patterns just like any other life form on this earth does?
Yeah. And of course we've created a lot of societal structure to things to help us be a bit more organized than the average, you know, animal roaming around on the planet. But
deep thoughts with Liz and stuff.
The average animal roaming around on the planet. But internally, I think there's a lot of truth to this. I think about it more and more. Every year I get older, I think about this. I try to remember what season I'm literally in. And if any of the struggle is coming from trying to resist the season I'm in, you know? Yeah, that is deep thoughts. There you go. Welcome to 2024.
Yes. And with the new year, we have, you know, new goals, but we also have new guests for you.
Yes.
So, and we're also trying something a little bit different with the structure of our episodes this year. So, you know, not everybody has an hour to listen to a podcast every week or every other week or whatever. So Liz and I were talking and we decided that maybe we would experiment with cutting the episodes in half. And so you can digest the first half of our talk with any guest and then let it process. And then maybe later on, we'll release the second half of that episode. And then you can have the full conversation at your in your brain.
Yeah. We've had some conversations about just feeling this general sense of overwhelm from our community and from people in general right now. I think everybody's just kind of overloaded a lot of the times. And, you know, unless your life is structured in such a way that you can commit time in a significant way, I think sometimes it can even just feel overwhelming to look at something and think, oh my gosh, this is almost an hour long. I don't know when I'm going to have time. Even if you could break it up yourself, maybe just looking at it and saying, oh, this one's only like 35 minutes long. I could listen to this on my drive, you know, and it'll be done. Mm-hmm. And so we're just going to give this a try and let us know what you think. I know a lot of you have been just enjoying this podcast and listening loyally for a long time and probably aren't bothered by the 55 minute time frame. So please let us know what you think too about us breaking it up. But we're also going to, just try to see what else we can offer you throughout the winter and spring this year.
Yeah, some exciting things that we're working on. So stay tuned here.
So the first guest of 2024, it's actually a conversation we recorded a while back, but just in terms of the production schedule, it worked out to be our first one of this year, is with my very good friend from college, brilliant trombonist named Ernest Stewart. And this was Steph's first time meeting Ernest, so I was like really excited about that. Because I've been wanting him to join us on the podcast for some time, and it was great to finally make it happen.
Yeah, I really loved meeting him. He's so thoughtful, and he has this like quiet exterior, but there's a lot going on and simmering underneath there.
Yes,
for 100%. And he's really done a lot in his career so far from being a jazz trained musician. He's definitely a jazzer, which is which is an awesome kind of flavor of musician that we haven't had on this podcast a lot. So it was really, really great to hear his point of view coming from that side of that genre, you know, of music, and just his attitude of just being open to whatever presents itself
for sure
to him
for sure
is really, really admirable.
Yeah. Yeah, he's had a really impressive career thus far. He's been on tours. He talks with us about the synchronicity of things in his life, which, of course, we love. And we also talk a little bit about his most recent career path shift, which is in the world of grant writing and grant making. And we just discuss a little bit about potentially what the artist's role is in that world and how maybe we're a little underrepresented in that part of things. So that was really really interesting too, to explore. It was just a great conversation. I'm really excited for everybody to listen to it.
Yeah. So enjoy this here, the first half of our conversation with Ernest Stewart.
Located in a historic mansion in Tacoma Park, Maryland, you might get the impression that the team at Potter Violins are as formal as the breathtaking building that they work in. But when you go inside, instead you'll find the most relatable, skilled, and friendly staff.
Yes, the people at Potter's are what really make it a special place. I love visiting because I know that whoever I work with is not going to make me feel like I'm crazy or just being picky. They're kind of like your favorite bartender. They're great listeners who give you what you need without judgment.
Yes, their technicians are not only super talented, creative, and resourceful, they take the time to collaborate with you so that the process of getting your instrument at its best really feels like a partnership.
So if you're in the area, definitely stop by and introduce yourself to Chris, Rob, Kimberly, Derek, Jim, Melissa, and the whole team, or visit pottervioolins.com to find what you need online.
It's so fitting then that their shop is in this beautiful old house because the staff at Potter's really makes it feel like home.
New York City-based trombonist Ernest Stewart is a recording artist, touring performer, arts administrator, and a true multi-passionate entrepreneur. As a freelance jazz musician, he frequently performs at clubs such as the Village Vanguard and the Blue Note. Ernest has also shared the stage with legendary musicians such as the Duke Ellington Orchestra and Aretha Franklin. From 2010 to 2017, he also toured internationally with Brooklyn Bhangra Band Red Bharat. In 2012, Ernest founded the Center City Jazz Festival in Philadelphia. The annual event has grown in popularity so much that it has become a must-attend destination for jazz enthusiasts from Philadelphia and its nearby cities. He has also recorded and released an album, Solitary Walker, and two EPs, Love, Loss, and Same Walking Animals, that all include original tracks. One thing is for sure, Ernest is most certainly an original himself. A fellow graduate of my alma mater, Temple University, I will disclose to all of you, our friends, that I consider this man family, and I'm so excited that we all get to chat today. Welcome to the Musician Centric Podcast, Ernest.
It's good to be here.
Yay. Yay, let's go. So I didn't mention this in your bio, but I feel like it's worth starting out talking about. You keep yourself pretty busy, sure, as all of us do. And over the years, we've had a lot of idea generation about things. But one of the things you did recently was, because you didn't have enough on your plate, you decided during COVID would be a good idea to go to Columbia University and get a master's in arts admin, correct?
Kind of.
as you do.
So I, you know, after about 2 weeks of sitting around during the pandemic, I was just like, all right, the tours aren't coming back. So I have to figure out what to do for the rest of this year or the foreseeable future. And I decided to begin looking at grad schools. I initially was looking to get a master's in performance, and that just didn't seem like the best use of my time. I wanted to broaden my education and broaden my knowledge. And because I went to school for undergrad as a performance major, I thought that I should do something less specific and more broad. So I then began looking at business class, just sort of, is there like any MBA programs that I can look at? And then I began thinking about the work that I've done with the festival and my sort of correspondences and time working with organizations, arts, nonprofits. I began to think seriously about the nonprofit world, and maybe my experiences were leading me there instead of just a sort of general business degree. So I decided to search around for nonprofit management degrees. And I landed on Columbia because they had a 1-year degree track, which is absolutely insane.
That sounds intense.
Yeah, it's a 2 or 3 year degree that is going to sort of be compressed into 1 year. And
wow,
it's Columbia, so they don't care about your personal time or life or comfort,
having a toddler mental, in the house,
mental health,
or, yeah,
you know, they're just like, I don't know. So I somehow convinced them to let me in. And I began, my original thinking was, okay, I'll take a year off of anything. And by the time that year is done, this is 2020, spring 2020. I'm like, by the time this year is over, we'll be back into the swing of things. I'll get to decide what tours are available and all of these things. So ultimately, I was wrong about that. I probably didn't need to do that in one year.
So you now have a new position where you are using that degree, right?
For sure. I'm a program director at Regional Arts Foundation, Mid-Atlantic Arts, which is very weird to complete the pivot. You know, like, it's one thing to initiate the pivot, but to actually complete the pivot is strange.
So you were coming from a pretty much all performing side of thing, right? Before the pandemic, you were touring, you were performing as a freelancer in New York.
Sure. Yes. And I also created a jazz festival.
Yeah.
So that's where all of my administrative...
So you were really kind of keyed into the needs.
Right.
The needs of performers and organizations. So now that you've completed your pivot, what do you see from the other side that you didn't see as like a performer? Where are you focusing your efforts now?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think one of the things that made me an interesting candidate for this position was my experience, because quite frankly, there's a lack of performers who actually pivot into a grant-making role. Yeah. You know, when you look around, there aren't very many people who have a long history as a performer making decisions about the flow of grants or money to places that ultimately serve performers and artists and things like that. So seeing how performers aren't in these roles or in these positions, it's really interesting to see how a lot of decisions were made prior to like me being there, where they were more centered on the institution, on the Performing Arts Center, and putting the Performing Arts Center in the center of the decision, to me saying, well, yeah, but what about the artist? You know, if it weren't for the artist, then these, you know, Performing Arts Center wouldn't exist.
We wouldn't need them.
And the vice versa isn't true. You know, without Performing Arts Centers, there would still be artists, there would still be musicians. And
totally.
All of these stuff, you know, so... Yep. How about we focus on the artist and think more critically about how to serve them and make their lives easier?
That makes total sense. It's interesting to even think about the fact that that's not necessarily the center of the focus up to this point. But again, I mean, this comes to representation at the table.
Of course.
If a musician isn't sitting there saying, hey, how does this apply to the person who's doing the performing? Right. Then how do they know? Right. How do they know?
Right.
Well, even just like a conversation being like, what is our biggest priority? And everyone being on the same page. Mm-hmm. It seems like everyone's doing their best, but they have a different priority or they're coming at it from a different angle. But if everybody just got on the same page.
Yeah, well, I think that's sort of, oftentimes funders have their own priorities and they just lean into that. And sometimes it's not artist-led ambition or goal. It's more focused on things that may eventually trickle down to artists, but ultimately there needs to be more artists sort of pivoting into these roles for sure. I think it's great to have artists who fill other roles like teaching, but arts administrators are often people who haven't gone on a tour or haven't had to survive off of gigs and finding gigs and hustling. And it's not to say that they aren't empathetic, but
of course,
it certainly affects the way that they might grant make, you know. And to answer your original question, that's what I'm seeing is as being the most sort of surprising thing that maybe I knew going into it, but I certainly wouldn't have this level of understanding until I was in the middle of it, you know.
Yeah, because for Center City Jazz Festival, you would have been applying for the grants. You wouldn't have necessarily been like making the grants.
Of course.
So, I mean, that in particular, like you have this targeted example of when you're applying for these grants, like if you ran up against any walls, you didn't know why, or you didn't really understand, or you didn't know what was available, or things weren't available that you needed. And now you're looking at it from the other side and saying, okay, I can kind of see why that's the
exactly.
case.
Exactly. And, you know, you begin to understand why certain organizations or people get money more frequently than others, you know. And I think some of those tables are turning. Mm-hmm. where applications are beginning to reflect the field a bit more and the ability of the field. You know, musicians tend to be sort of intimidated by applying for grants. Not everyone across the board, of course. But the reality is that the funds were going to people, and still do, go to people who are grant writers.
Yes.
But those aren't necessarily the most talented or the most visionary artists in the world. But there have been efforts made to bring the funding community to where the artist community, you see these efforts being made to make applications more streamlined and more simple. And how do we get to the crux of the project and this initiative? And it's been nice to see that for sure.
I'm thinking about this from the perspective of, we talk a lot on the podcast about just the structure that was in place for us in terms of education as musicians and what was perhaps lacking in that educational experience.
Oh, for sure.
And grant writing is a great example.
Oh, I think about that all the time.
Oh, it's so frustrating. Mm-hmm. Unless you go for arts admin, you don't have a clue how to write a grant. And I, you know, running my own stuff, I don't know how to do that because I don't have that skill set. Could I learn it? Well, yes. But how time consuming is it to then figure that out on top of everything else going on? Whereas if you just have a way to articulate your project in a compelling manner.
Well, you know, when we were at Temple, there was a writing component to the degree. We had to take writing classes, or at least I had to take a writing class.
Wait.
I had to take I had to take writing
Liz
classes.
Has blocked
I forgot
them out.
Like, you know, the things that we were writing about. It was great to give you a well-rounded education, but I also believe that we could have learned those same techniques while learning how to grant
write. Yes.
So grant writing could have been a part of the curriculum.
Oh, that's so good.
For artists.
Or, yeah, like one of the options, like you have to fulfill a writing requirement. Here's one that is career field related and you can opt for instead. Because, yeah, I mean, I enjoy creative writing.
Yeah.
But how to apply that to a grant, I have no idea.
And that's it's really interesting that even the business of music class was lacking.
Yes.
You know, and it
was like one.
And
right?
It just wasn't at all. Yeah. I think in order for these music programs, which are going to start, I'm sure they have already for years been struggling to maintain income from students signing up for these degrees. If they want to have any hope, they need to sort of rethink from the bottom up what their purposes are. And it's not just to tell people how to play a scale or how to improvise. That's only one part of the pie. Like, you have to be a functional artist, and you have to, if you want to make a career out of being an artist, there's so much more that goes into it, that it isn't, you know, just sit in this room, learn to play this scale. I mean, all that is extremely important, but that's not the only thing that's extremely important, you know?
I do feel like it is changing at universities. Like, you're seeing more of these business of music classes, and our friend Laura Colgate ran a program at University of Maryland where it was all about having an initiative, and the final project is actually implementing whatever that initiative is, you know, nonprofit or for profit or whatever it is, like almost like a Shark Tank kind of situation for college students. So that is coming around, I think. But yeah, it's definitely a big change from where we were, where it was like, you know, find an orchestra job or teach.
Or for jazz musicians, it's even crazier.
I've always kind of found myself on the other side of things. So when I went from being a touring musician to running a festival, you know, creating a festival, then running it and having to work with musicians from this other place on the bandstand as a presenter, it became clear just some basic functional things that jazz musicians,
jazz musicians were,
and this isn't, you know, a dig against jazz musicians as much as it's a dig. It is a dig, but it's a dig against sort of the music school, you know.
We have the same problem. I think unless you are in a position where you, like you said, where you're the presenter, or, you know, you're the facilitator, you're the one doing the hiring, or however you want to put it, the general field of musicians, at least from our generation and older, there are a lot of lacking skills. It's just that we're not taught to think that way unless you're wired that way. I mean, you're wired that way. Like, you were selling real estate too back in the day.
Oh,
right?
My goodness. Yeah. I forgot about that. I got my real estate license. Yeah. I got my real estate license.
Kind of.
I was, I remember turning 21 and having my real estate license. I guess I kind of always had that sort of inclination. You know, it was a really interesting time. Well, I got into real estate right as the bubble burst. And all those like subprime mortgages were like, it was ridiculous. Everything that was happening, you know, I was watching what's the movie with Brad Pitt?
The Big Short.
The Big Short. And I started having flashbacks about my life.
Wait, I was going to say, were you like, this is my life?
Yeah, it was so, I was triggered. I was like, oh my goodness. Yeah, I was there. You know, I mean, when people started realizing that they shouldn't buy that fourth home on a $50,000 salary, you know, it was just like, you know, it was a shock.
It's not funny.
It's crazy.
It's crazy. Super crazy.
And I remember bringing it back around to like music. You know, I was in school at that point. And I had finals and, you know, I was doing closings at the same time as like,
it was, you were like showing up, you were showing up to finals in your suit.
Yeah, it was crazy. It was such a ridiculous time. And it went from that to like almost overnight went to no one is calling the offices. No one, you know, because all of those adjustable rate mortgages started creeping up and everyone started freaking out and getting scared. So it just instantly the bottom was taken out of the real estate market. And I was sitting around like, oh my God, what am I going to do? Because all of my interest or all of my focus rather was sort of going towards real estate. And I must've been like, you know, like a freshman or sophomore or something. And I was not working, no income, nothing was happening. And I got a call from this trombonist named Brent White, who needed me to sub for him on some Atlantic City shows. And it just instantly like, oh my goodness, what have I been doing? Like music is showing up again to save my life. You know, I've been ignoring it this whole time, focusing on these real estate ambitions of mine. But, you know, the reality is that music was going to bail me out. And it did. And I walked out of my real estate office that I was working out of, like a Century 21 office, and never went back.
You know, I think that's so interesting because we can all relate. All of us here can relate because I personally left music after I graduated and I just got a completely unrelated job in telecom because that was the time that I was graduating.
I love it so much.
Anyway, telecom was still a thing. And I became a project manager. I was like a 21-year-old project manager, you know, telling all these developers and telling them what to do. And then I had this moment where I was like, what am I doing? What am I doing? I need to have music in my life because there was no music in my life. And then I came back to it, started taking lessons, auditions, etc. But Liz, you have a similar story too, where you walked away and then came back.
Went and did that Central Pennsylvania stint for a little while. And I worked, I mean, I stayed adjacent because I was in entertainment booking for events and stuff. I always explain it as a voice for me. It was just like this internal voice that just got louder and louder every year. And it wasn't that I wasn't in a good situation. I was in a really good situation with a lot of future potential. And the person who runs that business, she's like family still. And actually the hardest part was leaving because of that. But she was so encouraging of me pursuing my reality that it was okay. But it's interesting too, because I really feel like, I don't know, the real estate story is, it's like you're riding this wave and you're like making this money and you're doing really well at it. And so your brain is going, okay, this is working. This is working. This is working. Then it starts to fall apart, which is of course a lesson in impermanence that nothing lasts. And lo and behold, this thing presents itself to you. That is like synchronicity to the ultimate. And I also want to say, it's really interesting for me to think about as your friend and knowing you back then, because, and maybe you felt it, maybe you knew it. There was a point where all of a sudden, all of us who were your friends were like, holy bleep, Ernest, like something happened to you. There's this fire that just got lit under you. And you are a beast on your instrument. You're so good. And it was just like, you were free. Something happened and it just felt like you were free to just be a musician and you let it go. I don't know how else to explain it. And I don't know if that resonates, but that's my perception of your experience when we were younger.
Yeah. You know, I got to a point in school where I realized that I had a couple years left at Temple.
With
amazing people. And I really had to come to grips with the fact that if I never got called for a gig from any of my professors, it would be my fault. Because I knew that that was a potential source of from other professors or, you know, sort of looking around town to see what was happening around Philly at the time.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
You know, trying to figure out, okay, how can I do this? How can I do this?
Yeah.
So I basically put a lot of energy into, okay, I'm not very good at the trombone right now. I need to get much better in order for this to be viable. You know, like I like in order for me to work, I can't be bad at the trombone, you know? Like it's just, it's not going to work. So
this isn't going to happen. Yeah.
Yeah, it just isn't going to happen. I'm not going to get called. So I basically began doing anything I could to get better. You know, I remember this one time I was at Ortlieb's, this jazz club in Philly. And during this period of time, someone told me that I didn't sound good playing rhythm changes, which is like a type of song form like the blues. And just like, man, you don't sound good playing rhythm changes. You sound like you don't know what you're doing.
I
want to
know who said that.
So
I know.
So I went home that night. It was probably like 1 o'clock in the morning. And I sat in the back seat of my car, like in between the two front seats. And I just played rhythm changes for hours. Like I wasn't getting out of my car until I felt like I had gotten like a little better playing rhythm. And like that just kicked off this whole thing where it's just like, I'm not going to accept this level of, even now, after this pandemic and all of the other crazy things that have happened over the past couple of years, I went back and began taking lessons again, just jazz lessons, cool. Because I'm like, hey, I'm not playing as well as I want to be playing right now. I have to get back into this rhythm. I want to make sure that that part of my brain doesn't atrophy. You know, I need to keep learning and
right,
understanding
right.
this music. And I think sort of veering off into a different topic, when you're touring and you're playing music all the time, especially if you're on tour for like 6 years, 5 years, 3 years even, you can just dial into that music and the needs of that gig and only
you're incredibly proficient in that
exactly
lane.
And your proficiency in that lane grows, or you get like as good as you need to be in order to be successful to maintain that sort of work, and that's what you do. And you begin to realize like, oh my goodness, I can't do this other thing anymore, or I, you know, it becomes scary. And eventually you kind of have to get to the point where you're like, okay, I need to fix this. And this isn't the first time throughout the years. I was on stage playing with John Legend and I'm like, my chops suck. You know, like I feel like I'm barely hanging on, you know, like I'm like my trombone playing has suffered a lot over the years. So right after that tour ended, I began taking trombone lessons, just basic trombone lessons, not jazz, not just learn to play your instrument. And still that led me to other lessons like, okay, let me take some jazz lessons. Let me do this. Let me do that. And humbling myself and like, I need some information from you. Can you teach me something? You know?
Yeah. That area, that place of growth happens, I think, when we allow ourselves to feel like beginners at something.
Yeah.
What do I think I know that I don't really know?
Yeah. Well, it's always
and
fascinating.
Make yourself vulnerable. It's about being vulnerable. You're vulnerable to accept that criticism and not let it beat you down, but let it feed you.
Yeah, of course.
And yeah.
Yeah. And I think about other artists who are always shifting and changing their product or whatever they're producing as their art. It's always amazing to me that people are willing to take risks. And anytime you take a risk, you have to assume some level of vulnerability. And I think that maintaining it, you know, the person that I'm taking lessons with now, they're younger than me, you know, like they're a kid, you know, but I'm very happy to say, I have no idea what I'm doing. I stink at this. I need your help. And I have no problem doing that. You know, I have no problem with it.
Well, there's always something to learn. For the record, though, you've never really been bad at the trombone. Let's just get that out in the open now.
I mean,
we are all our own toughest critic, but you know.
Thank you so much for listening today. If you loved this episode, consider writing us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
Thanks also to our season sponsor, Potter Violins.
If you'd like to support the podcast and get access to bonus content, consider joining our Patreon community.
You can buy all your musician-centric merch, including shirts, water bottles, koozies, and a variety of other fun items.
Our theme music was written and produced by JP Wogan and is performed by Steph and myself.
Our episodes are produced by Liz O'Hara and edited by Emily McMahon.
Thanks again for listening. Let's talk soon.